Good to be back with you again here at Payton City. I was here in 99, and since receiving the invitation to come back and be with you, I've looked forward to that. I appreciate so much the invitation to come back and preach again here in the gospel meeting, and that invitation encourages me far more than you may realize. We'll have more to say at the next hour and other nights about the lessons that we have planned. I hope you'll make your plans to be with us and encourage others to come and be with you as well. Will? I want to spend our time this morning, since we're limited in our time, talking about the fear of God. We'll move right into our study. We'll say more about the lessons we have planned at the other hours. Let's talk about walking in the fear of God. One of the most impressive subjects in all the Bible to me is the concept of the fear of God and walking in the fear of God. We cannot do complete justice to the subject in the time that we have allotted. We could do a series of sermons on the fear of God and still not do complete justice. And I have done that at home, done series of sermons on the fear of God and still not exhaust the subject, because the Bible says so much about the fear of God. It's one of my favorite subjects in the Bible. I want us to begin with the concept that the fear of God has to be taught. Let's start by looking at Psalm 34 and verse 11, if you will. The fear of God has to be taught. If you fear God, it's because someone took the time to teach you the fear of God. You didn't just soak that up by being around people who fear God. If your children fear God, it's because you've taught them to fear God. The fear of God has to be taught. It has to be learned. Psalm 34 and verse 11 says, "Come, you children, listen to me, and I will teach you the fear of the Lord." We'll come back to Psalm 34 if time permits a little bit later. I don't know of a single chapter in the Bible that tells me more about the fear of God than Psalm 34. Psalm 33 and 34, those psalms go together. We'll say more about Psalm 34 a little bit later. Here's another passage in Deuteronomy, chapter 4 and verse 10. The text says, "Especially concerning the day that you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, 'Gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words,' now notice this, that they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth, and they may teach their children." That they're going to learn to fear me, and then they're going to turn around and teach their children to fear me. The fear of God has to be taught. Here's another reference along the same line. The 14th chapter of Deuteronomy, verse 23, the text says, "And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and of your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and of your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always." Now, we could go on citing passages to talk about how fear has to be taught, but we learn that the fear of God has to be taught, it has to be learned. And if you fear God, you've learned that, and if those that you're around fear God, it's because you or someone else has taught them to fear God. There are two objectives that we have in our study this morning I want us to seek to accomplish. When the lesson is through, I hope that we've accomplished this objective to help us to walk in the fear of God. What I mean by that is, then I hope you have a renewed interest. I'm sure that your very presence this morning is indicative of the fact that you are one who fears God and that you're trying to walk in the fear of God. I hope that's the case. But when we get through with this study, I hope that you have a renewed interest, that you are more determined than ever before that I want to walk in the fear of my God. I want to fear God. The second objective is I want to challenge you to study more about the fear of God. Here's what I want to challenge you to do. That from this point forward, and we don't have to have an ending time on that, because if you do this, there will not be an ending time in your study. You'll just go on and on as long as you can continue to study. But I want to challenge you to study more about fear. And that is in your private study. I'm not meaning that you sit down one day and decide, you know what, I'm going to study the fear of God today. But you might be studying from Psalms, or you might be reading from Revelation, or you might be reading from Genesis, preparing for a Bible class, or you might be listening to a sermon. You might be going through a workbook and studying some references on the home and on the marriage. Whatever it is that you're studying, every time you come across the fear, the term fear as it is directed toward God, stop and underline that, make a mark in the margin of your text, and raise some questions. Mark every reference you see on fear, and you raise this question, what do I learn from this verse about fear? That sounds like a simple matter. I think if you do that, you'll find that's one of the most rewarding studies you've ever done. I've issued that challenge in a few places where I've gone to meetings and then go back a few years later into the area. I've had people tell me that is one of the greatest studies I've ever done. is just mark every reference with the fear of God and raise a question in my mind, what does this passage teach me about fear? What does it tell me? And I think you'll find that's one of the most rewarding studies. It's amazing to me that after years and years of studying the fear of God, I still come across references with reference to fear that I've not seen before, I didn't notice before. If you'll do those two things, have a greater determination to fear God, and study more in the fear of God, our time will be well spent. You realize the Bible talks about a number of people who make claims to fear God. While it talks about a number of those, it's not on every page of the Bible. Of all the Bible characters, not every character, they may have made that claim, but they didn't use the expression, the fear of God. Here are some of those who claim to fear God. We're not going to notice every one of these in detail. But Joseph, remember in Genesis chapter 42 and verse 18, he identified himself to his brothers. When they came into Egypt, and then he finally identified himself that I am Joseph, and he identified himself as being one who feared God. I fear God, he said. Here's another example. Jonah identified himself with those that were on the boat with him in Jonah 1 and verse 9, that I fear God who made the sea and the dry land. There's an important concept from that we'll come back to a little bit later in defining fear. But he identified himself as one who feared God. I wonder what's wrong with us identifying ourselves as I'm one who fears God. Sure, you ought to identify yourself as a Christian. You ought to identify yourself as a member of the Church of Christ. Not be ashamed of either of those. But what's wrong with telling people, the reason I don't do what you're asking me to do is I fear God. Or the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is because I fear God. That's what Jonah did. Now notice in Nehemiah chapter 1 in verse 5 and verse 11, this is an interesting concept because Nehemiah identifies himself and the people with whom he was associating in this post-exile period as those who desire to fear your name. Notice that in verse 11 particularly of Nehemiah 1. These are the people who desire to fear your name. And then Abraham is an example. By the way, back to Nehemiah just for a moment. But Nehemiah identified himself identified his brother in Nehemiah chapter 7, Hananiah, is one who feared God more than many. I find that interesting. There may have been others who feared God just as much as Hananiah, Nehemiah's brother, but he identified him as one who feared God more than many. What an epitaph to be written on your tombstone. So here lies one who feared God more than many. What an expression to describe someone's life. Now Abraham, in Genesis 22 and verse 12, here is an example of one who obeyed God to the utmost. Here is an expression that describes one that God now uses the expression. In these other passages, Nehemiah is saying, we fear God. Jonah said, I fear God. Joseph said, I fear God. But here's a case where God says that now I know you fear me. This was the case where God had asked Abraham to take a knife and to slay his son, his only son, and sacrifice him. And it wasn't until he draws back the knife ready to kill his son, God stopped him and said, now I know you fear God. When you're willing to obey to the utmost without question and without doubt, now I know you fear God. God would ask you to do the same kind of thing. And you finally came to the point you were ready to do that. Would it be then and only then that God understood and God now recognizes that you fear his name? Here were some people who claim to fear God. Let's go a little further now. And I want us to notice four basic points in our study this morning. First of all, let's talk about that this is our purpose and our summation in life. This is what life is all about. Let's turn in our Bibles to Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13. And as you're turning there, let me give you a quick synopsis of what Ecclesiastes is about. This is a pursuing the purpose of life is what the writer of Ecclesiastes, which I believe to be Solomon, if you believe it to be someone else, whoever it is that's writing Ecclesiastes, he is pursuing man's purpose in life. And so he pursues perhaps that life is about pleasure, and he found out that was vanity of vanities. Maybe it's pursuing wealth. He attained that was vanity of vanities. Maybe it's wisdom, and that was vanity of vanities. And when he finally comes to the end of the book, he comes to this conclusion, chapter 12 and verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole beauty of man. King James says, the New King James says, this is man's all. This is what makes man whole, and this is his whole responsibility. This is all that man is to do. This is the chore that God has given for man. And what is it? To fear God and to keep his commandments. That's our purpose in life. If you want to summarize what life's about, life is about fearing God. That's man's purpose, and his summation in life. Let's go to the book of Proverbs 23 and verse 17. The text says, "Do not let your heart envy sinners, but be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day." So what am I to be doing all the day? I am to be fearing God. That means that's what I'm to do all day today. That also means that's what I'm to be doing all day tomorrow. And that's what I'm to be doing all day the next day. And every day that I live, I'm to be fearing God. That tells me that's my purpose in life. Now, there are some conclusions that I have to draw from that. If that be true, that tells me then if we fail in that, we have failed in life. Show me someone who's been a success financially. They have great education, but they don't fear God. And I'll show you someone who is an utter failure in life. You say, "Oh, they're great success." I don't know they're not. Because man's purpose in life is to fear God, and if he doesn't fear God, he's an utter failure in life. Here's a second conclusion. If our children don't fear God, then we have failed in the rearing and the raising of our children. I recognize there are exceptions to that. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it." It's a proverb. It's a general statement to which there are exceptions. It's possible to train a child right and him turn out wrong. I understand that. And so I'm dealing in general principles that if we rear and raise our children, and our children do not end up walking in the fear of God, we have utterly failed in the rearing and the raising of our children, generally speaking. Because we are to train them in the walk in the fear of God. But you say, you don't understand. I gave them the best education there was. And my children are great professionals. They're making more money than we ever made. If they don't fear God, they're utter failures in life. Here's another conclusion. If that's our purpose in life, then that means that those who do not fear God have no meaning in life. Does it take a Solomon to figure out why some people take their lives? I'm not dabbling into psychology and trying to explain why everyone takes their life. But does it take a Solomon to figure out that people take their lives because they've lost meaning in life and they have no purpose for living? If you don't fear God, then you don't have a purpose in life. You don't have a proper purpose in life. And so the conclusion has to be that if that is our purpose, then those who do not fear God have no meaning in life. That's why people want to take their life and maybe take the lives of others is because they do not fear God. Here's the second thing we want to consider. We want to establish the fact that those who fear God are those who please God. I want to quickly notice this so we'll have time for some other points. Let's just establish from a few passages that those who fear God are those who please God. Let's look at, for example, Acts chapter 10 and verse 35. "In every nation, he who fears God and works righteousness is accepted of him." He that fears God and works righteousness is accepted of him. God accepts and is pleased with those who fear God. Let's skip Psalm 2 for time interest and go to Psalm 34 and verse 9. Psalm 33 and Psalm 34 go hand in hand. If you want to study the fear of God, spend some time studying Psalm 34 and take Psalm 33 with that as well. But verse 9 says, "Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, there is no want of those who fear him." And then notice verse 15. This may sound familiar to you. "The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open unto their cry." Does that sound familiar? Probably not because of your familiarity with Psalm 34, unless you just recently studied that, but because you've heard that from 1 Peter chapter 3. And where did Peter get that? Peter's quoting from Psalm 34, that the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their cry. He listens to the prayers of those who are sinners, or those who are saints and not those who are sinners, those who are righteous. It's in the context, verse 9, of talking about those who fear God. So I conclude from that those who fear God are those who please God. Now, the third thing I want us to talk about this morning is we talk about fear. I notice that's my purpose in life. It's those who please God who fear God. Thirdly, let's talk about what fear is and what it means. If we were to go down the street and ask people, what does it mean to fear God? I think we would get all different kinds of concepts of the fear of God. I was recently having a private Bible study in a jail with a young man who was in jail for a year. There's another preacher in the same room having a Bible study across the room, and he commented to me that most people misunderstand fear. I said, "That's right." He said, "Here's what fear is," and I forgot what the exact explanation was, but when he got through, I thought, "You're one of them that doesn't understand. You have no clue. You have no concept of what fear is." If we were in a Bible class and we were to ask, what is the fear of God? Someone would say, "I think fear of God means you're afraid of God." And that's true, but that's only partly true. Someone else would say, "I think it means you stand in awe of God." And that's true, but that's only partly true. I want to suggest to you that the fear of God is like a coin, in that it has two sides. It has a heads and has a tails. It's like the two sides of a coin. The heads and the tails are distinct and they are different. They're not the same. But they're also inseparable, aren't they? You ever gone to the bank and say, I want a roll of quarters, but I want the ones with the heads. I want the tails. You keep those. Can't do that, can you? If you take the heads, you have to take the tails. And if you have one, you have the other, but they are distinct. They're not the same, are they? The fear of God has two sides to that. And let's start with the first. The fear of God involves being afraid of displeasing God. If we truly fear God, we are afraid of displeasing God. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 11 and in verse 7. Here's a classic passage, classic definition of the fear of God. This is when Saul and Samuel are trying to rally the people to go to battle with them. Here's what they said. They took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hand of the messenger, saying, whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. Put your finger there and let's come back to that. Get the picture now. They take a yoke of oxen and they cut him up into bloody chunks of meat. And they send messengers throughout all the territory and they come knocking on your door. And as you come to the door, here stands a messenger with a bloody chunk of meat, blood dripping off on your doorstep. And he says to you, if you don't go to battle with us, the same thing will be done to all of your oxen that was done to this one. Now keep in mind, your oxen is not a pet you have in the yard, but that's your livelihood, that's your bank account, that's your investment, that's your retirement. You have a whole herd of oxen out there. And if you don't go to battle with us, the same thing will be done to your oxen that was done to this one. Let's go back to the text and see what the text said. And the fear of the Lord fell on all the people, and they came out with one consent. Well, no wonder. They were afraid not to. You see how that the fear of God was used with reference to being afraid of displeasing God? Here these people were trembling and they were afraid. And the text says the fear of God fell upon them. Here's another passage. Look at Psalm 119, verse 120. My flesh trembles for fear of you, and I am afraid of your judgment. Someone said, oh, I don't think we ought to be afraid of God. These texts tell me I ought to be afraid of God. I ought to be afraid of displeasing God. I ought to tremble in my boots at the concept of doing something that God is displeased with. We have just a smattering knowledge of Old and New Testament history of those who displease God. That ought to make us afraid. Isaiah 66 and 2. For all those things my hand has made, and all those things exist as the Lord, but on this one will I look. Here's the one that God favors. Now notice. On him who is poor and of a contrite spirit, and who trembles at my word. Remember, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Hebrews 10, 31, chapter 12, 29 tells us why our God is a consuming fire. Now, that's one side of the coin, that we ought to be afraid of displeasing God. When God says that all liars will have their part in the lake that burns with fire, it ought to scare me to death, tell a lie. I ought to tremble at the idea of doing that. When God tells me to do something like I ought to partake of the Lord's Supper and assemble on the first day of the week, I ought to tremble at the idea of not doing what God tells me to do. But let's flip that coin over, and there's another side of that coin that is inseparable, but it is distinct. And on the other side of that coin, here's what we have. That the fear of God also involves respect and awe for God, standing in awe of His greatness and His power and His might, standing amazed. Look at Luke 7, 16. Here's a classic definition of that aspect of fear. As you're turning to Luke 7, let me set the stage. This is the story of the raising of the son of the widow of Nain. Jesus is making his way into the city of Nain, a walled city, with a throng of people, and as he enters into the city, coming out of the gate of the city is what we would call a funeral procession. They're carrying a young man in a coffin, an open stretcher, as we would refer to it, and they're carrying him out to bury him. Jesus goes over to the mother first and tells her to not be upset, if I might paraphrase that. Then he goes over to the open coffin, raises the young man from the dead, brings him back and presents him to his mother. And now let's pick up in the story at verse 16 of Luke 7. The text says, then fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen up among us, and God has visited his people. Were they standing back and afraid that he's supposed to do something terrible to us? Not at all. They're standing amazed at his power. A great prophet has been here. God's been with us today. They stand in awe of God and of his power and of his might. How would you react if you were at a funeral procession and saw that kind of thing? Look at Jonah 1 and verse 9. Jonah 1 and verse 9 says, therefore, since Jonah 1 and verse 9, I'm sorry. He said, he identified himself, I am a Hebrew, and I fear God, the God of heaven who made the sea and the dry land. Now look at that for a moment, how he described the fear. I fear God. What do you mean by that? The one who made the sea and the dry land. I stand amazed. I think he's emphasizing this aspect of fear. The one who created it all. I stand in fear of him, is what Jonah's saying. Deuteronomy 28:58. One more passage on that, and then we'll move on. In Deuteronomy 28:58, if you do not carefully observe all the words of this law that are written in this book, that you may fear this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God. So you say, what is the fear of God? Well, one who truly fears God is afraid of displeasing God, but at the same time, he stands in awe of his greatness and his power and his might. That's the fear of God. Now let's move and talk about our last point. Let's talk about what fear causes us to do. If I truly fear God, and I truly stand in fear of God, what will that cause me to do? How different will my life be? How will my life change? If I've not feared God before and I start fearing him now, how are things going to be different in my life? And let's list some things in the time that remains. Here's the first thing I want us to notice. And that is that, first of all, we'll do whatever God tells us to do. We'll do what God says. Which tells me that if I'm not willing to do what God tells me to do, then I don't fear God. I just don't fear God at all. Let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy. Let's go to Deuteronomy 6 and verse 2. And as you're turning there, let me tell you why Deuteronomy is so important. I said earlier that Psalm 34 is probably, if I had to pick a single passage to talk about fear, I would talk about Psalm 34. But if I had to talk about a book, pick one book of the Bible to talk about fear, without question, it would be Deuteronomy. And here's why. Deuteronomy is, by its very title, the second giving of the law, or the reiteration of the law, as I like to refer to it. The law has already been given. It's not really being given again, but it's being reemphasized. On the verge of going into the land of Canaan, God is taking his law through Moses and emphasizing it to the people. There is a need for walking in the fear of God. There's a need for emphasis to the laws and the statutes and the commands, and their need to abide by that. They need respect for God and for his word as they enter the land of Canaan. So the book of Deuteronomy probably says more than any book of the Bible about the fear of God. If you want to start a study of the fear, start in the book of Deuteronomy and read through it and underline the word fear, and you'll find numerous times expression is used. But let's start in Deuteronomy 6 and verse 2. That you may fear the Lord your God. Okay, now what does that mean? Let's read further. To keep all his statutes and his commandments which I commanded you. That if you fear God, you're going to keep all of his commandments and all of his statutes. Two chapters later, chapter 8, verse 6. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. Now there's one more reference along that line. Deuteronomy 13 and verse 4. That you shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and hold fast to him. Now, we could go on and on citing numerous passages where the concept of fearing God means you do exactly what God says to. That's what it means to fear God. Here's something else fear of God involves. It means you'll be dedicated and you'll be devoted. You'll be dedicated and you'll be devoted. Show me someone who has been baptized, who attends church most of the time, but your description of them would be that, you know, they're just not really on fire. They're not real dedicated. They're not devoted. You can't really count on them. Every church has somebody like that, I'm sure. We have them at home. Yeah, they've been baptized. They come most of the time, but you wouldn't describe them as being real dedicated and devoted. That person truly doesn't fear God. The fear of God means you'll be dedicated and devoted. Let's notice some passages. Deuteronomy 10 and verse 12. What does the Lord God require of you but to fear the Lord your God? He requires you to fear. All right, what does that mean? To walk in all of his ways and to love him and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. Fearing God means you love Him with all your heart and all your soul. You put everything you have into that. That's dedication and that's devotion. Look at verse 20, same chapter. You shall fear the Lord your God and serve Him, and you shall hold fast and take oaths in His name. You're going to hold fast to Him. You're going to take oaths in His name. Deuteronomy 31:12 says, gather the people together, men and women and little ones, and stranger who is within your gates, that they may hear and they may learn to fear the Lord your God and do what? Carefully observe all the words of this law. Numerous times through Deuteronomy that you're carefully observing the words of this law. Here's something else the fear of God will cause you to do. It'll cause you to hate and despise sin. Rather than being tolerant of it and just kind of frowning on it sometimes, but yet you kind of enjoy the sin. You hate it and you despise it if you truly fear God. Proverbs 3 and verse 7. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. There's some connection between fearing God and departing from evil. If I'm not departing, I must not fear God. Proverbs 8 and verse 13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, the text says. Proverbs 16 and verse 6. By the fear of the Lord, one departs from evil. By the fear of the Lord, one departs from evil. Now, I want us to notice an interesting passage now in Exodus 20 and verse 20. And as I cite Exodus 20, you might recognize that, hopefully you do, as the passage talks about the giving of the Ten Commandments earlier in the chapter. But when we get to verse 20, here's what we read, that Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you that His fear may be before you, that you might not sin. That's interesting. He gave the Ten Commandments and said His fear needs to be before you. In other words, don't fear man, but fear God, is what the text is saying, so that you might not sin. In other words, you'll keep these commandments if you fear God, and if you don't, it's because you don't fear God. Psalm 55:19 made this point. Psalm 55:19 said, God will hear and will afflict them, even he who abides from old, because they do not change, therefore they do not fear God. Here are people who are not willing to make a change in their life. Therefore they don't fear God. You ever scratch your head and wonder, I wonder why so-and-so won't be converted? I'm wondering why brother so-and-so won't give up his sin. And we scratch our heads and we wonder, I don't understand the problem. Well, here's a passage that explains the problem. They don't fear God. There's your explanation. Now, why don't they fear God? I may not understand all of that, but I do understand the text. Say, because he doesn't change, he doesn't fear God. Let's move to another point. If I fear God, I'm going to honor God. I'm going to hold God in high esteem. I'm not going to refer to God as a buddy of mine. It's not going to be kind of a casual relationship with God. There is going to be deep and abiding honor of God. Remember Nehemiah described himself as and the people that they were associating with as those who feared God, who desired to fear your name, rather? Go back to Nehemiah 1 and verse 5. And notice Nehemiah 1 and verse 5. Nehemiah began to pray, and he prayed unto God and said, O great and awesome God. Later in chapter 4 and verse 14, same book, he said the great and awesome God would defend you and fight for you. And we could go citing other passages to talk about the concept of honoring God. We hold God in great high esteem, that He is the great and the awesome God. He's not some casual acquaintance, but He's great and awesome. Now this is quite interesting. While we're in the book of Nehemiah, go to the 8th chapter if you will. Nehemiah chapter 8, beginning about verse 2. This is where Ezra the scribe came before the people, and he stood on a pulpit of wood, and he opened the book in the presence of them all, the text said. Remember that? And as he opened the book in the presence of them all, I want you to begin reading with me in verse 2 and 3. So Ezra the priest brought, now remember, this is in the context of those who desire to fear your name. That's how Nehemiah described these people, who desire to fear your name. They brought the book of the law before the assembly of the men and the women so that all could hear on the first day of the seventh month. Verse 3 now, then he read from it in the open square that was in front of the water gate from the morning until midday before the men and women and all those who could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law. They were attentive and they were listening. But here's what's interesting, verse 5. And Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was standing above the people, and when he opened it, all the people stood up. Why'd they do that? Was it because of their respect for Ezra? Not at all. I don't know what they were doing, where some of them were standing, some of them were sitting. But there was something about opening the book in the sight of all the people. The very opening of the book caused the people to stand up. I want to tell you, there are some occasions in life where you rise to your feet. When the national anthem is played or sung, now I'm an American and I'm proud of it. I come to my feet. You can say it if you want to, but I come to my feet. I have a hobby of meeting, collecting political memorabilia, and meeting some political figures. I've shook hands with 6 presidents. And when you walk into a room where the President of the United States is, you come to your feet. Whether you like him or dislike him, you like his policy or you hate his policy. For respect for the office, the Bible says honor the king, I come to my feet. Here's something far more important than a flag, a country, or a president, and that's the book of God. When he opened the book in sight of all the people stood up. Does that mean that when we read the law that we all have to stand? That's not the point. The point was that was descriptive of their attitude, of a respect for the law of God. Contrast that to people who today may say something like this. Have you ever heard a Christian say, I know the Bible says that, but, and then they give an explanation for living otherwise. Well, here's another thing. And that is, that if I fear God, I'm going to respect and treat other people right. Then my respect for God means I have some respect for other people. And I'm going to try to treat them the way they ought to be treated. And let's look at a couple of passages along that line. Let's go to the book of Leviticus, if you will. 19 and verse 4. Leviticus is filled with expressions like this. We're only going to notice a couple in Leviticus. Leviticus is filled with expressions of a contrast between fearing God and then mistreating people. I'll give you an example right here. Leviticus 19 and verse 14. You shall not curse the deaf nor put a stumbling block before the blind. But they're saying don't mistreat people. But you shall fear your God. And notice the wording is not don't mistreat people but treat them right. That's the point. That's not the word. He's saying, don't put a stumbling block before the blind. Don't curse the deaf. But in contrast to mistreating people, you fear God. What does that mean? If you fear God, you'll treat them right. That's what that means. Same chapter, Leviticus 19, 32. You shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man. Show respect for older people. Show respect for some who are elderly. What does that mean? And fear your God, I am the Lord. In other words, if you don't fear God, you won't respect other people. You'll rise before the gray head and you'll honor the presence of an old man. You fear God. Show me someone who doesn't have respect for older people and I'll show you somebody who really doesn't fear God. Fear of God means you'll respect other people. Go back to the book of Nehemiah. Remember now, I remind you that Nehemiah 1 and verse 11, he described this as the people who desire to fear your name. Keep that in mind as we go to chapter 5. Chapter 5 shows there was an internal problem among the people where brethren were abusing brethren. They were exacting usury, charging an exorbitant amount of interest, taking advantage of people who were in need. You could imagine if someone were in need here, instead of maybe giving them money or helping them, that you loan them money for 21% or 30% interest. You take advantage of the situation. And you're trying to gain from their problems. That's what they were doing in the book of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah condemned them, saying, that's not good. And here's what he said, verse 5, or chapter 5, verse 9. What you're doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of our nation, our enemies? They were abusing their brethren, and he doesn't come along and say, you should not abuse your brethren. What he said is, you should have feared God. That's an interesting way to condemn that. You ever heard someone, maybe some brother mistreating another brother, and one of the elders go and tell him, what you ought to be doing is fearing God? We don't word it that way. But that's what Nehemiah was saying. He is implying that if you fear God, you'll treat your brethren right. Show me where there's problems between brethren and they're not treating one another right. Somebody doesn't fear God. Because that means that we'll respect and treat other people right. Well, here's some practical lessons we'll draw in the minute or so that remains. If all of this be true, then here's some conclusions we have to draw. That one who fears God is more than one who has been baptized. A lot of people have been baptized, but that doesn't mean they fear God. One who fears God is more than one who goes to church all the time. There are a lot of people who go to church all the time, but they don't truly fear God. And I conclude from that when one marries, they should marry one who fears God. I started a long, long time ago. I've got a daughter in the first year of college and a boy in the first year of high school. I started when they were 4 or 5 years old, as we would have Bible time, as we would call it, telling them that you need to marry one that fears God. And I would tell them, I want you to do more than marry a Christian. I want you to do more than marry someone who's been baptized and goes to church all the time. That's not good enough. You need to marry someone who truly fears God. If they marry someone who fears God, that marriage will be all right. Now, they may marry a Christian, in quotation. One who's a member of the Church of Christ, they may marry one who's been baptized and attend services, but that doesn't mean the marriage is going to be all right. They marry someone who fears God, and if they fear God, that marriage will be all right. Won't have anything to worry about. Teach your children to marry those who fear God. And here's one last conclusion, and the lesson is yours. That what we ought to be doing is striving to be more dedicated, more devoted, and sacrifice more. And if we've accomplished that purpose and that goal of a greater desire to walk in the fear of God, our time has been well spent. I appreciate your attention.